All right, so right now I'm joined with Tim McSorley from the Media Co-op, who was in Durban covering the COP17 Climate Change Conference. Thank you very much for joining me, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
I guess just to start with kind of more of a general question, what are your thoughts on kind of the conference itself and the role of the Canadian government within the conference?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to point out that there were two conferences kind of going on parallel to each other. There was COP17, which is the official UN climate change conference, and then there was also the C17 conference, which was organized by civil society and brought together activists and environmentalists from across, mostly from across Africa, but internationally as well. So there was a pretty drastic contrast between the two. But just as far as COP17, for myself, as an independent journalist and somebody fairly new to covering these kinds of conferences, it's a fairly overwhelming experience in some ways because it is so large. There's so many delegates, and a lot of the decisions, a lot of the discussions are it's very kind of jingo-y and a lot of kind of bureaucracy to kind of wade through. So just getting there and trying to dive in was a little bit difficult. At the same time, though, there were a lot of environmental organizations and a lot of countries who weren't happy with how some of the negotiations were going and were looking for a really strong accord to come out of COP17, who were more than willing and available to help kind of cut through some of the bureaucratic talk and to make it a lot clearer. But just overall, it's a very closed environment and very difficult to kind of get into, and also enforces a lot of very official kind of rigor that kind of blocks out a lot of more marginalized voices and a lot of voices that are most impacted by climate change right now. So, for example, there was a large conference of rural women from across South Africa that was happening in Durban at the same time, and they weren't allowed to participate in any of the events or to speak to any of the delegates, even though they're facing some of the most drastic impacts of the climate change right now. Even for officially accredited NGOs and media, there's limited access to different sessions and limited access to plenaries and very strict regulations. So there were some activists who, during a press conference, even just did a bit of theater. They dressed up as a climate clown for their press conference, and then afterwards were just giving interviews in costume outside the press conference room, and they were ejected from the conference because they said that they were breaking the decorum and the agreement that that NGOs are supposed to have with the conference. And so there's very little room for people who are, I think, the most affected by these impacts, and there's very little room for just a general understanding. And I think that's why it's very hard to track and understand what's going on or have a solid feeling of what's going to come out of the conference until the very end.
Mm-hmm.
Even to the point where at one point there was a fake document that was circulated in the early morning hours towards the end of the conference that was actually, it turned out, meant to undercut some of the better agreements that were coming out. So there had been overnight a fairly strong version of an accord that wasn't great, but was much stronger than what people were expecting to come out of Durban that would extend the Kyoto Protocol. And then just several hours later, this fake document came out that undercut a lot of those positions and really did a lot to slow down negotiating and to build a lot of cynicism. And so it kind of points to the fact that that there isn't a lot of negotiating in good faith even that happens in these kinds of conferences. So there's a lot of questions. I think the pessimism that kind of came out of it is kind of warranted to a large degree, and I think it raises a lot of questions about the future of these kinds of conferences, that if countries aren't going to be there in good faith, how effective they can be. And I think Canada's the epitome of that. Going in, saying already that they wouldn't agree to a second round of Kyoto or an extension of Kyoto, the fact that whether it was leaked by the government or actually leaked to undermine them, the fact that it came out on the first day of the conference that Canada was going to be the first country to consider pulling out officially from the Kyoto Protocol, it all served really to just undermine the sense that something could be accomplished and that we could push for something better and an effective accord to come out of COP17. And I think Canada, along with several other countries, shares a large part of the blame for that.
Now, I mean, in talking about that, the dynamics here, the politics of, you know, the people being really affected by this aren't let in, and sort of the obtuse nature of it. What was the presence of Canadian media there? Was there a lot of Canadian media other than independents like yourself there?
From what I could tell, there wasn't. I didn't meet every media representative there, but as far as I could tell, talking with other Canadians we came across, there was very little Canadian media coverage on the ground there. There was Mike D'Souza from Post Media and Jeffrey York from the Globe and Mail, and then six of us from the Media Co-op here in Canada, and two other Canadian independent filmmakers from Victoria who we were working with. But apart from that, there was very little on the ground mainstream media coverage. There were also a few Quebec independent outlets, so Gaia Presse and some others who had people writing from them from Durban. But really, on the ground, it seemed like there was a clear lack of Canadian media coverage and Canadian media presence. And I think that to a certain degree, that was reflective of the feelings going into it. There was already quite a bit of cynicism going into COP17 about whether what kind of accord or whether an accord would come out of it. And so I think that served to kind of demobilize the media from sending enough people. But I think that in itself is really problematic, because even at times when it feels like there's no accord that's going to come out of these conferences, they're still viewed as the main decision-making body when it comes to reaching an international agreement on climate change. And to ignore it and to not focus resources on covering it, I think, is a mistake. Even though, like I say, personally, I'm pretty cynical about what happened there. But at the same time, we need to be shining a light on it until, there's an alternative, and until there's a clear movement in another direction. I think it's important that that people the world over, and especially in Canada, concerning the Canadian government's actions, knows exactly what's going on and what's being said about Canada and our country's stance there. Mm-hmm. Likewise, I think that there needs to be parallel coverage of alternative movements and stuff like the C-17 conference, the kind of the anti-COP conference that was going on in Durban at the same time. And there, really, there was no mainstream media coverage. I didn't see any coverage in the corporate media of alternative voices. There was a little bit, especially from NGOs, groups like the Canadian Youth Delegation at COP17. But really, the coverage of alternatives and what people are proposing apart from COP17 was non-existent in the Canadian corporate media.
Now, talking about the activists and NGOs that were there, I wanted to get your thoughts on their actions. Mm-hmm. Do you think they were successful in kind of getting a point across, or no?
I think it was really mixed. I think there's also a broad range of environmental NGOs that exist and that were there. So I think to a certain degree, there's Justice Network, Climate Justice Now. They held daily briefings and did an excellent job in getting a radical alternative view out at COP17, and many of their members were also involved at C17. And they were providing a bit of the bridge between the two conferences, bringing information back to C17, and also, like I said, bringing a more radical perspective to COP17. Whether or not their voices were heard in the official decision-making, there was a large march, a global day of action on December 3rd, where at the end, a memorandum bringing together the different positions of various kind of radical climate justice groups was presented to the head of the UNFCCC, the body that organizes the COP and runs the COP17 conference. They said that they would present it to other delegations and make sure that it had input, but from what I can tell and from what the agreement that was reached, or lack of an agreement, rather, it seems like it was just lip service to what the NGOs were doing,
mm-hmm.
and the positions presented. And at the same time, I think we need to be kind of critical of ourselves and some of the larger NGOs. So at the very end, on the last day, official day of COP17, there was an action organized inside the conference center, kind of in line with the Occupy COP17 that had sprung up, where basically there was a rally and a speak out inside the conference hall that really gathered a lot of energy and brought a lot of people together. But at the same time, it was originally organized by some of the larger NGOs, including Greenpeace and others. And a lot of people started speaking out and called for a sit-in. And then just as it was getting going, there was a call from the head of Greenpeace for people to not do a sit-in, even though that had just been kind of agreed to by consensus and kind of an Occupy style of presenting something and people signaling their consent. And starting to sit down, and instead it was kind of it was contradicted, and people were asked to, instead of occupying, to leave the premises, to hand in their badges, to not resist being removed, and to hand in their badges as a sign of protest and leave the conference center, which really did a lot to demobilize, because there were a lot of people who were ready to sit there and to stay the night and to make sure that they weren't leaving the conference center until there was some kind of pledge that a better agreement would be reached. And instead of supporting that, some of the larger NGOs who rely on funding from either governments or not necessarily governments, but from large foundations, that clearly demobilized that. And it was very frustrating for a lot of people on the ground. And I think that to a certain degree, yeah, we need to be critical among each other of what actions we take and whether or not some groups are willing to push the envelope far enough to really have an impact.
It's excellent that you started to talk about that, because my next question was that NGOs, corporations, governments, in a lot of ways it's one hand washes the other in the relationship between those elements. So because of that, so do you think that there needs to be a change of tactics? Because I mean, the environmental movement has been, I guess, doing these sorts of things and doing certain types of tactics for the last decade and more, and hasn't really gotten a lot of headway. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that the issues facing the environmental movement are similar to what's been facing a lot of other social justice movements, and I think that you're right when you say that there's this issue of one hand washing the other. We have a situation that other colleagues of mine at the Media Co-op and the Dominion have kind of highlighted, and a lot of other people have as well, about issues around organizations, environmental organizations, getting funding from large foundations who are in turn funded often by oil companies and companies that these groups on the ground are supposed to be actively fighting against. And there's a real chilling effect when it comes to questions about whether or not these foundations will continue to fund organizations if they take drastic action. There's also the question of access. So definitely, and it's a question that I can understand it. It's a debate that needs to be had. But when you're at a conference like COP17, as I mentioned, just with the example of somebody wearing a costume being evicted and having their accreditation removed, there's a serious question about whether or not actions that are taken will result in losing access to these official conferences, both in the immediate and also for future conferences.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a question that weighs really heavily on groups when they're thinking about what actions they're going to take inside conference centers, whether or not there's a space for direct action or disruption when it's clear that voices aren't being heard. And so, I can't profess to, being there to cover as a journalist, I wasn't taking those actions either, and so I'm mindful to not necessarily criticize when I'm not taking those actions clearly myself either. But I think something more does need to be done, because just for myself personally, it's probably been clear to other people long before this who have gone to other COP conferences that the solution isn't being negotiated at these conferences, that really that there's a too large a presence at these conferences and influence at these conferences of private corporations who have a significant impact on how these negotiations go. Not in that, you know, there's some kind of conspiracy or cabal, but in that at the end of the day, the solutions that are being reached are still based on market mechanisms. And a large part of that is influenced because it's the large companies who are continuing to, who have the money to do the lobbying and to have the influence on government policy. And so until that ends, we're not going to be seeing, or we won't see a strong accord coming out of these conferences, it seems. And that means that there needs to be really strong actions. There needs to be disruptions. There needs to be people speaking out. And at the same time, creating alternatives. And so I think it's something that we need to be talking about more. I think there's a lot of groups on the ground, a lot of groups that are focusing on climate justice and aren't affiliated with larger NGOs who are starting to keep this in mind and are really working to build solidarity with indigenous communities and impacted communities, and also avoid falling into those pratfalls around funding. But I think a lot more needs to be done, and especially a lot more needs to be done in the public consciousness, because it's still the larger NGOs who kind of take up the most of the media scape.
Yeah, and I guess another question, and I mean, you're kind of alluding it to well, is like, how do you, in talking about these big problems that need to be solved as far as getting the message out there. So I mean, like, how again do you even measure success with something like this, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not too sure exactly how environmental activists and stuff like that can start to maybe think of things maybe differently. I'm not sure, but I don't know what your thoughts are on that, on how they could measure success differently, or maybe how that factors into it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think it's a difficult question as well. I don't know if I have my answer. You know, yeah. I think even for us at the Media Co-op and the coverage we do, you know, we sometimes struggle to figure out how we measure success. You know, is it purely based on the number of readers? Is it the quality? Is it the impact on government policy? I think often, at the end of the day, especially at these, I think it depends on what people are doing, but I think at the COP conference, at the end of the day, the way people measure success is often whether or not they have an impact on government policy and the accord that comes out, which I think in some ways needs to be the target. But I think after a certain point, I think that's coming too, and a lot of people were talking about at the conference that at a certain point, a system is so broken that you can't really fix it, and to continue struggling and only measuring your success in whether or not a strong accord comes out of COP17, it's kind of like banging your head against the wall. And so I think a lot of groups can also measure their success in the type of media coverage they get and in impact on public opinion. Mm-hmm. So looking at polls and things like that, and whether or not they're swaying opinion. I think groups like the Canadian Youth Delegation did a pretty solid job of breaking into the mainstream media and getting critical messages out. The Canadian Youth Delegation was a group of 18 young environmental activists from across Canada who were there at COP17 and held regular press conferences and actions, and several of them were actually evicted at one point for standing up in protest, wearing t-shirts criticizing Peter Kent during his speech at a plenary, Peter Kent being the Canadian Environment Minister. And so, I think that's one way of measuring success, but I think we also have to figure out our own levels of success and how we do that. So for myself, I think something that we were successful at and that we want to build on was building contacts with other independent media covering environmental issues, building contacts with climate justice activists across the world, and being able to continue to build a different narrative and build more information about how people are resisting outside of the context of things like COP17. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a big part of, I think if we look at the C17 counter summit, that I think one of the successes people would point to at that would be the amount of contact and support and solidarity that came out of that. I think there still needs to be more. A lot of people at C-17 were speaking about the People's Accord on the Rights of Mother Earth that came out of Cochabamba in Bolivia a few years ago. And there was talk of how important that is to use as a roadmap. And I think we need to maybe get back to that, because one of the things that maybe, just to offer my own little bit of criticism on the other side too, is that it felt that often these counter summits are too reactionary and too focused on simply responding to what happens at something like COP17 and not necessarily building and focusing on building our own alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And our own structures, which is difficult because so much, again, of the official negotiating and the media landscape is taken up by COP17. There does need to be a response. So how do you do both is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's one thing that if we're going to be talking about success and moving forward is to really focus on organizing ourselves differently and not simply responding to what comes out of COP17.
Yeah.
Or other COP in the future.
Yeah, I mean, kind of you're talking about banging your head against the wall, you know, it kind of reminds me of what Antonio Gramsci said when he says that if you beat your head against the wall, it is your head which breaks and not the wall. And
yeah,
that is, he says, you know, that's my strength, my only strength. So I guess maybe there's a lot of truth in what you're saying and what Gramsci said in that quote. Thank you very much, Tim, for joining me and talking about this very important issue. A lot of important questions. If people want to read more of your coverage and other things that the Media Co-op provides, where can they do that?
Yeah, all our coverage from Durban is still online at mediacoop.ca/Durban. Or just for our general coverage, there's mediacoop.ca, and then dominionpaper.ca is the website that where we specifically publish content from the Dominion magazine, so people can find information at both those places, and thanks a lot for having me on.